This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Sappho in Fragments, the fourth installment of Cabinet's Poetry Lab series, with special guest Anne Carson. It took place on August 24th, 2009.
Okay, folks. Good evening. Hi, I'm Graham Burnett, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you here this evening. I'm going to introduce a few people to get us going. First, let me just go ahead and ask, could everybody make sure that their cell phones are turned off? Great. So let's see. Jeff Dahlman and I have the great pleasure of welcoming you guys to what is now, the fourth installment of Poetry Lab, hosted by Cabinet Magazine. And a very special thanks goes to Cabinet for making this event possible. Those of you who don't know, Sina Najafi is in the back, the founder of Cabinet Magazine. This is his home. He lets us use it by this. So thank you to Sina and to Rio, who's in the back, who holds up the We also, of course, have very special guests with us tonight, Anne Carson and Robert Curry, who will be joining us in the middle of this evening's events, goings on. I'm going to start by talking just a little bit about Poetry Lab itself, about Sappho. Those of you who've been to previous Poetry Nights know that there's some project-y kind of stuff in store for you, so we'll ask you to join in good spirits for those parts of things. And I suppose I should also say an extra special thanks to Ali for the fans. There are fans floating around, which is a brilliant idea to keep people functional. We hope that that helps with the heat, but we know it's hot here. So a word about Poetry Lab. This set of events has been a kind of continuation of a graduate seminar that Jeff and I taught at Princeton that was really an enormously important experience for me, certainly. I think it meant a lot to him, too. A course in which we work to try in a way to get perpendicular to the ways we ordinarily read text or engage with poetry. So we ask people to sort of test the limits between reading as a process of criticism and creative making or artistic production. And that's the kind of spirit of these events, and that's the way they've unrolled so far. The specific kind of program for the evening will unfold as we go, but we're about ready to dive in with Sappho herself. We do have copies of Cabinet for sale, yes? So there's a table. It's a little buried. Our commercial sensibilities are not especially well developed, it should be said. But there's a table back there, and the current issue testing is on sale. Many of you probably know, and has written for Cabinet before, so there are issues available. With that, I'm going to hand things over to Jeff to get us thinking about Sappho.
There's a certain amount of ad hocery to these proceedings, but the precision of the choreography will have been obvious to those of you who could see Graham Burnett's name playing across his forehead as he swayed back and forth there. So we're off to a good start. Sappho is our subject, the poet we're invoking tonight. And I just want to say a little bit about her, move to the far edge of my expertise, and then defer to the group, and then defer to some proper experts. But she was born in 610 BC and died probably about 40 years later, seemed to have lived on the island of Lesbos. And in the course of thinking about this, I pulled down an 1895 edition of the poems by Henry Thornton Wharton, and he calls her the one great woman poet of the world, which will sound like a slightly comical assertion to us, not least for its kind of a late imperial self-confidence. But it does say something about the extent to which her reputation kind of held the stage from her own time until our own. She was very quickly canonized among the Greek lyric poets, and that canonicity has persisted. In life, she seems to have been the head of a community of women brought together by shared religious and pedagogical, and some scholars will refer to this as a thiasos, And her poetry, those of you who've read it, it's filled with the properties of Aphrodite's rituals. So flaming incense, sweet balms for the hair, and the sort of properties and the powers of desire, desire for men and desire for women. And to that subject, desire, we're going to let Sappho speak herself. What we're going to talk about here mostly is fragments, the way that these poems have come down to us, the forms that they take, or the frustrations of form that they pose for us. Why fragments? Why is Sappho's corpus such a tissue of scraps, orts, and bits? There are really two reasons for this. The first is that some of her texts survive for us because they were quoted by grammarians who thought of her as an authority in matters of language and used her to exemplify points about conjunctions or possessives. So here is a page from the Campbell edition in the Loeb Library of Sappho, and you can see the fragment in question is as long as you wish. Wait a minute, where am I here? Nope, that's not it. Forgive me. This is from Herodian on anomalous words. So Herodian's study of peculiar words. Where to get those peculiar words? Let's look to Sappho. Let us return to the matter under discussion, namely toule. So this is what he's interested in, right? This word, toule, funny word, means cushion, which was not used by Attic writers, but is used by Sappho in Book 2. And I will lay down my limbs on soft cushions. Note that the te is not a conjunction. All right? And much fun is made of the grammarians for handling such hot coals with philological oven mitts, right? I will lay down my limbs on soft cushions. Note that the te is not a conjunction. So some of the poetry comes down to us in these ways. The other reason why these poems are so often in fragments, consist only of fragments, is because of the sheer perishability of the medium itself. This is a reconstruction of a papyrus. And you can see, we'll be making much ado of this, all of the empty space, all of the words unaccounted for, all of the conjecture that has to fill in those blank spaces. And I'll give you another page from this edition just to see what happens, right? So here, you can see the white space where the papyrus is torn. And here is a translation of the text as it can be recovered. You would wish, little, be carried sweeter. You yourself know, too, has forgotten, someone might say, for I shall love, as long as there is breath in me, will be a matter of concern. I say I have been a firm friend, grievous, bitter, but know this, I shall love, for it is better, missiles. So, why are these so powerful is one question, right? There's something about the recitation of these sort of compact scraps of text that's so mysteriously evocative. And I just want to toss out a couple of reasons why that might be the case. One, that the sort of broken character of passionate speech, since we have that when we are at our most urgent, our sentences are least constructed, and that these outbursts have something of that character. Maybe they're only defined as outbursts formally, but once they're isolated like that, they have a kind of passionate pith that surprises us, that ambushes us. And it's possible, I think, to imagine that that's how poetry happens, particularly if you have some notion of poetry as inspired, as coming from the gods. Sometimes it comes in tripping iambic tetrameter, as it did to Coleridge, right? So, you know, in Xanadu, did Kublai Khan a stately treasure dome decree and pleasure dome, and he just writes it off fluently. But for the most part, I think poetry arrives in bits and pieces, and then the question is for the poet what to do with it, what to make out of those shards. And that's one account, right, of what the activity of poetry is, poiein, to make, that it's the making of something out of the given fragments. And the doing of poetry is just sort of accounting for the mysteriousness of these bits. And that can lead you to an idea of poetry, I think, that suggests that the only real poetry is the fragment itself, right? The rest is just rhetoric. It's just the stitching. It's just the way that you piece these brilliant fragments together. And that idea of poetry and its opposite, the poetry as only the fragment, the poetry as what is made of the fragment in the creation of the poem, I think those are two ideas that we'll be playing off one another tonight, because we'll be working with fragments of this of these texts, but we'll also be trying to make something with them. And there will be the question every time we try, every time we sit down, as you will, with charcoal and paper in emulation of these papyri, am I making something as thorny, as fragmentary, as likely to cut my tongue as Sappho's fragments, or am I trying to make something that will make this wisdom palatable, that will give it to us as the more made thing of a poem? So that's as much as I'll say about the question of fragments. Graham and I wanted to talk a little bit, or what we wanted to do is read a few examples of what some poets from the 18th century to the present day have made of Sappho, and then we'll get down to business.
So it's worth saying that the question arises when you have a set of shards, to what extent do you want to try to smooth the passages between those broken elements and afford them the kind of flowing continuity that might accord with a certain sense of the lyric, and to what extent you permit them that raggedness. And so what we've chosen is an array of different translations of fragment 31. And we'll do about six. I think we should just do them. We'll do them all, but we'll do them briskly. And the thing you want to be thinking about is just let the radically different treatments of these elements flow over you. And it will serve as a useful preparation for what will follow next, which is we're actually going to hand out some fragments. We're going to work with some fragments together. So shall I dive
yeah,
in?
Yeah, go ahead and maybe step one? Out of the okay. light.
Fragment 31. He seems as fortunate as the gods to me, the man who sits opposite you and listens nearby to your sweet voice and lovely laughter. Truly that sets my heart trembling in my breast. For when I look at you for a moment, then it is no longer possible for me to speak. My tongue has snapped. At once a subtle fire has stolen beneath my flesh. I see nothing with my eyes. My ears hum. Sweat pours from me. A trembling seizes me all over. I am greener than grass. And it seems to me that I am little short of dying. But all can be endured, since even a poor man. David Campbell, 1982.
Campbell, the editor of this literal translation now. Happy as a god is he, that fond youth who placed by thee, hears and sees thee sweetly gay, talk and smile his soul away. That it was alarmed by breast, and deprived my heart of rest, for in speechless raptures tossed, whilst I gazed, my voice was lost. The soft fire, with flowing rain, glided swift through every vein. Darkness o'er my eyelids hung, in my ears faint murmurs rung, chilling damps my limbs bedewed, gentle tremors thrilled my blood, life from my pale cheeks retired, breathless I almost expired. And that's John Addison in 1735.
Okay. Fragment 31. Equal to Jove that youth must be, greater than Jove he seems to me, who free from jealousy's alarms, securely views thy matchless charms. Ah, Lesbia, though 'tis death to me, I cannot choose but look on thee. But at the sight my senses fly. I needs must gaze, but gazing die. Whilst trembling with a thousand fears, parched to the throat my tongue adheres. My pulse beats quick, my breath heaves short, my limbs deny their slight support. Cold dews my pallid face o'erspread, with deadly languor droops my head, my ears with tingling echoes ring, and life itself is on the wing. My eyes refuse the cheering light, their orbs are veiled in starless night. Such pangs my nature sinks beneath, and feels a temporary death. And that's Lord Byron, about 1820.
fragment 31. And in this, you'll hear in the final lines what becomes the signature of the sapphic in English, which is a final line that has a dactyl and trochee, da-da-da-da-da. Peer of gods he seemeth to me, the blissful man who sits and gazes at thee before him. Close beside thee sits and in silence hears thee silverly speaking. Laughing love's low laughter. Oh, this only stirs the troubled heart in my breast to tremble. For should I but see thee a little moment, straight is my voice hushed. Yea, my tongue is broken, and through me, neath the flesh, impalpable fire runs tingling. Nothing see mine eyes, and a noise of roaring waves in my ears sounds. Sweat runs down in rivers. A tremor seizes all my limbs, and paler than grass in autumn, caught by pains of menacing death, I falter, lost in the love trance.
John Addington Symonds, 1883. A little bit more of this. Basil Bunting, 1927. Fragment 31. Oh, it is godlike to sit self-possessed when her chin rises and she turns to smile. But my tongue thickens, my ears ring. What I see is hazy. I tremble. Walls sink in night. Voices unmeaning as wind. She only, a clear note, dazzle of light, fills furlongs and hours. So that my limbs stir without will, lame. I a ghost, powerless, treading air, drowning, sucked back into dark, unless rafted on light or music, drawn into her radiance, I dissolve when her chin rises and she turns to smile. Oh, it is godlike.
Fragment 31. That man is pure of the gods who face to face sits listening to your sweet speech and lovely laughter. It is this that rouses a tumult in my breast. At mere sight of you, my voice falters, my tongue is broken. Straightway, a delicate fire runs in my limbs, my eyes are blinded, and my ears thunder. Sweat pours out, a trembling hunts me down. I grow paler than grass and lack little of dying. This is just to say that was William Carlos Williams in 1958.
Two more. Fragment 31. He is more than a hero. He is a god in my eyes, the man who is allowed to sit beside you. He who listens intimately to the sweet murmur of your voice, the enticing laughter that makes my own heart beat fast. If I can meet you suddenly, I can't speak. My tongue is broken. A thin flame runs under my skin, seeing nothing, hearing only my own ears drumming. I drip with sweat. Trembling shakes my body, and I turn paler than dry grass. At such times, death isn't far from me. Mary Barnard, 1958.
Fragment 31. I set that man above the gods and heroes. All day he sits before you face to face like a card player. Your elbow brushes his elbow. If you should speak, he hears. The touched heart madly stirs. Your laughter is water hurrying over pebbles. Every gesture is a proclamation. Every sound is speech. Refining fire purifies my flesh. I hear you. A hollowness in my ears thunders and stuns me. I cannot speak. I cannot see. I shiver. A dead whiteness spreads over my body, trickling pinpricks of sweat. I am greener than the greenest green grass. I die.
Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about how the next hour or so is going to go. The center of the evening is a sort of 15-minute performance piece that we're going to run through from Curry and based on Anne's translation. And that's going to come in the middle of things. And we have kind of bookends for that part of the evening. And they're each about 15 to 20 minute exercises. They are based on the idea of the fragment. So we actually have right here some fragments, some broken plates. And I want to show you what those plates began as. It is true that most of the stuff we have comes off of papyrus for Sappho, but it is not unheard of for us to have inscribed plates or terracotta bits or marble tablets. And what we've got tonight is a set of terracotta tablets inscribed with Sappho's poetry, mostly in English. There's a little bit of Greek hiding on some of them. And these, after having been created at some considerable pain, but at the same time a pretty great party at the same time, have now all, in a moment of ritual anacreonic ecstasy, been shattered and are now in a bucket here. And we never know how many people are going to show up for poetry night. So we were, on a Monday night at the end of August, we were aiming for between 14 and 18. So I'm going to go ahead and pass out the fragments. Our idea had been for everybody to have two. We think we have about 70 fragments. But you may need to certainly only take one, and you may need to break your fragment with a friend. And then basically what will follow will be something like 20 minutes of sociability, let's say, where the object of the game is going to be to try to reconstruct, to the extent you can, some of the original tablet that you have. There are about 11 or 12 complete tablets that were here. So you're going to have to move around the room. It's not going to be easy, but you have to look to see what you can make out of these bits. And I want to say just a word about maybe as these go around, and don't be afraid to break them more if they're needed, because it's, you know, that's the work. There are some cues to the differences between them. They were done in different hands. They have slightly different patinas or finishes on them. So those are clues in some cases. There's markings on the backs of some of them that may help. For this 15 or 20-minute exercise, the object will be to try to reconstitute what has been lost or broken. However, in keeping with the sort of spirit of the Poetry Lab, when we reconvene after our reading from Bracco, the piece built around Ann Carson's translations, when we do this exercise again in about 20 minutes, the object will be to reassemble not the original tablets, but to work to make new poetic elements by reassembling the fragments not in the way they go. So for the next 20 minutes, you're going to be working to reassemble the fragments that I've shown you here. But when we do this same exercise with the fragments in another half an hour, you can do whatever you like with the fragments. You work from the words that are on them to make new poetic bits. And for that second bit, later on, we'll hand pencils around so you can record what you've made. So to make it very straightforward, for the next 20 minutes you're working with the people around you to see if you can reconstitute the fragments of Sappho's poetry that have been here broken.
So and, this is a big exercise in archaeological gregariousness. Get up and find your fellow shard holders. And as you begin to assemble tablets, and as the words become clear, lay them out on the table on the white.
Yeah, lay them out on the table, right? That's part of the idea. Pits have to go to the table. Okay, so so we're about ready to reconvene. It's my great pleasure to introduce a little bit more formally now Ann Carson and Robert Curry. And I think you're going to talk for maybe just a moment. Tell us a little bit about this piece and where it yes. comes from. Ann.
We
oh, the two chairs, by the way.
Yeah. Here you go. If you guys want a little mic.
That will happen.
Okay.
wanted to put that word in to allow people to know that there's a thing there, not just me skimming on. And so then Curry figured out a way to make that idea into a kind of choral piece with four voices. So we have Curry and me doing the text in a configuration that has to do with clouds, and you don't have to know that. And
we use weather maps in.
So really, it's a beautiful thing. The clouds are actually superimposed over the text on the page. So where, so that what the clouds cover is what is read.
Okay. And then there are the brackets read by Jeff, and then there are some footnotes read by Graham. They all went and watched together in layers.
And then the original time it was done, it was actually, we were working on this really long, big piece, and we got really tired of it, so we asked a friend to choreograph 15 minutes. So first thing we were shown, Mitchell and Marcy Merline choreographed this piece for us when we originally did it. And they both did for the worst kind of Indians.
Can people hear in the back? You guys, a little bit more.
Okay, so they both danced with the Cunningham Company. Today when we were thinking about this, we were thinking about fragments, we thought we should dedicate this to Merce Cunningham and John Cage, because they were really the people that taught us about how to see the whole in each fragment. So, on with fragments, I guess. Or Bracco.
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 And do you want to tell us a bit about the image, too? We have the video image.
Oh, yeah, it's just the, we're able to find, you know, the joys of the internet, you know, we were able to sort of construct with a friend what the nice guy would be over Lesbos in about 650 BC. So we made a star night of floating rank. So at one point, it's the only dramatic moment in the piece.
Don't tell.
Oh, okay.
Fragment 2, bracket.
Hear to me from Crete to this holy temple. Where is your graceful grove of apple trees and altars smoking with frankincense? And in it cold water makes a clear sound through apple branches, and with roses the whole place is shadowed, and down from radiant shaking leaves sleep comes dropping. And in it a horse meadow has come into bloom with spring flowers, and breezes like honey are blowing.
Bracket, bracket.
In this
place,
you, Cupris,
taking up
in gold
cups delicately,
nectar mingled
with festivities,
pour.
Fragment 4, bracket.
Heart,
bracket.
Absolutely,
bracket.
I can,
bracket, bracket.
Would be for me,
bracket,
to shine in answer,
bracket.
Face,
bracket, bracket.
Having been stained,
bracket. Fragment 8, bracket, bracket, bracket.
Aethys for you,
bracket, bracket. Fragment 12, bracket, 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 bracket.
Thought,
bracket.
Bear,
bracket, 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 bracket. Fragment 16.
Some men say an army of horse, and some men say
an army on foot.
And some men say an army of ships is the most
beautiful
thing on the black earth. But I say it is what you love. Easy to make this understood by all. For she who overcame everyone in beauty, Helen, left her fine husband behind and went sailing to Troy. Not for her children nor her dear parents had she a thought. No.
Bracket.
Led her astray.
Bracket.
For.
Bracket.
Lightly.
Bracket.
Reminded me now of Anactoria, who is gone. I would rather see her lovely step and the motion of light on her face than chariots
footnote
of Lydians.
Footnote 4.9.
Or ranks of
having
good
been
soldiers
stained.
In arms.
Bracket. Depending on how the first
not
letter
possible
of this
to
word
happen.
Is restored.
Bracket.
It may also
pray
mean
for a share.
Having been touched on the surface, caressed, or having been tainted, defiled.
Bracket, 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 bracket.
Toward.
Bracket, 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 bracket.
Of the unexpected.
Fragment 21. Bracket, bracket, bracket.
Pity.
Bracket.
Trembling.
Bracket, bracket,
bracket. Flesh by now old age.
Bracket.
Covers.
Bracket.
Flies in pursuit.
Bracket, bracket.
Noble.
Bracket.
Taking.
Bracket.
Sing to us. The one with violets in her lap.
Bracket.
Mostly.
Bracket.
Goes astray.
Footnote 53.
Fragment
the
24A.
Graces, the charities. In
bracket. Bracket.
Drive from charis.
You will remember.
Grace. Bracket.
Are three in number.
In our youth,
embodiments of beauty or charm.
Yes, many and beautiful things.
And the attendants
bracket,
of Aphrodite.
Bracket. Fragment 24C. Bracket. Bracket.
We live.
Bracket.
The
opposite.
Bracket.
Daring.
Bracket. 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 Fragment 24D.
Footnote 96.7.
Bracket. Bracket.
Rosy fingered.
Bracket. Bracket.
An
bracket.
Adjective used
in
habitually by
voice.
Homer to
bracket.
Designate the red look of dawn.
Quit.
Fragment 25.
I think Sappho means
bracket.
Here to be startling.
Bracket.
But I don't know
quit.
How startling.
Bracket.
When she
bracket.
Moves the epithet
luxurious
to a
woman.
Nocturnal sky.
Bracket. Bracket.
Also
bracket.
Startling is the fecundity of
fragment
sea,
26.
Field, and memory.
Bracket.
Which appears to
bracket.
Flow from this uncanny
those,
moon and fill the night world of the poem.
Bracket.
All swung
bracket.
From
crazy.
A thread
bracket.
Of
bracket.
As
bracket.
Sometimes
bracket.
In
you
verse 7.
I want
bracket.
Homer
to
too
suffer.
Likes
bracket.
To extend the simile
myself,
this way.
In myself I am aware
creating
of this.
A parallel surface
bracket.
Of
bracket.
Such tangibility
bracket.
It rivals
fragment
the main story for a minute.
Bracket.
Homer
bracket.
Is more concerned
deep
than
sound.
Sappho to
bracket.
Keep the borders of the two
fragment
surfaces intact.
Bracket.
Epic
bracket.
Arguably differs from lyric
lady.
Precisely in the way it manages such rivalry.
Bracket. Bracket. Fragment 37.
You burn me.
Fragment 42.
Their hearts grew cold, they let their wings down.
Fragment 45.
As long as you want.
Fragment 47.
Eros shook my mind like a mountain wind falling on oak trees.
Fragment 51.
I don't know what to do. Two states of mind in me.
Fragment 52.
I would not think to touch the sky with two arms.
Fragment 57.
What country girl seduces your wits? Wearing a country
dress,
not knowing how to
pull the cloth to her ankles.
Fragment 74A, 74B, 74C. Bracket, 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 bracket.
Goat herd.
Bracket.
Longing.
Bracket.
Sweat.
Bracket, 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 bracket.
Roses.
Bracket, bracket, bracket. Fragment 78. Bracket, bracket.
Nor
bracket
desire
bracket
but all at once
bracket
blossom
bracket
desire
bracket
took delight.
Fragment 84. Bracket 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 bracket
reproach
bracket
delicate
bracket
Artemis
bracket. Fragment 86. Bracket
quiet
bracket
with an aegis
bracket
Kithaeria I pray
bracket
holding the heart
bracket.
Hear my prayer if ever at other
times
bracket
forsaking
bracket
toward my
bracket
harsh.
Footnote 140.
Fragment 87D.
Kithaeria is a name
bracket,
of
bracket,
Aphrodite.
Bracket bracket
youth
bracket 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 bracket. Fragment 88B. Bracket
me
bracket bracket bracket
you
bracket bracket.
Shall love.
Bracket. 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 Fragment 88A. Bracket. Bracket.
In front.
Bracket.
Towards.
Bracket.
Loosen.
Bracket.
You would be willing.
Bracket.
Slight.
Bracket.
To be carried.
Bracket.
Someone.
Bracket.
More sweetly.
Bracket.
And you yourself know.
Bracket.
Forgot.
Bracket. Bracket.
Someone would say.
Bracket.
And yes,
I,
bracket,
as
long as there is in me,
bracket,
will
be a care,
bracket.
I say I have been a strong lover,
bracket, bracket,
painful,
fragment 175, bracket,
bitter,
bracket, bracket,
and know this,
bracket,
whatever you,
bracket,
I shall love,
bracket, bracket,
four,
bracket,
of weapons,
bracket. Fragment 104A.
Evening, you gather back all the dazzling dawn has put asunder. You gather, gather a lamb, gather a kid,
gather
a child to its mother.
Fragment 104B.
Of all stars, the most beautiful.
Fragment 115.
To what, O beloved bridegroom?
May I compare you to a slender sapling?
Footnote 146.
Do
I compare you?
Since bees and honey are frequently associated with Aphrodite,
but if you love me, choose a younger bed, for I cannot bear to live with you when I am the older one.
The proverb may also imply a renunciation of all things aphrodisiac.
But me, you have...
Other translations occur to me. Such as
129B,
mellow smelling honey, yellow stinging bee, honey, no,
Eros,
not me.
The melter of limbs, now again stirs me, sweet, bitter, unmanageable creature who steals in.
Fragment 133.
Andromeda
has a fine exchange.
Sappho, why? Aphrodite, giver of blessings.
Fragment 140.
Delicate Adonis
is dying. Kithria, what should I do? Strike yourselves, maidens.
And tear your garments.
Fragment 143.
And gold chickpeas were growing on the banks.
Fragment 146.
Neither for me honey nor the honey bee.
Fragment 147.
Someone will remember us, I say, even in another time.
Fragment 156.
Far more sweet sounding than a lyre, golder than gold.
Fragment 168B.
Moon has set, and Pleiades, middle night, the hour goes by, alone I lie.
Fragment 173.
A vine that grows up trees.
Fragment 174.
Channel.
Fragment 175.
Dawn.
Fragment 176.
Liar, liar, liar.
Fragment 177.
Transparent
dress.
Fragment 189.
Soda.
Fragment 190.
Many skilled.
Fragment 191.
Celery.
Fragment 192.
Gold.
Ankle bone cups.
Footnote 166, cited by Athenaios, Diapnosophisti, 2.57d, in order to comment on the spelling of the word for egg. This egg may be the one from which Castor, Pollux, Helen, and Clytemnestra were born, although swan's eggs are whitish, not blue.
The end.
Okay. Who counted the mistakes?
Okay, so I think that that, with this wonderful kind of making of the holes into something of the object in the thing, leaves us primed for what will be the last exercise of the evening. So the idea here is to work again with the fragments, which we're going to recollect and scramble. And here you'll probably want to break off into some kinds of groups, probably to some extent self-formed. And the idea will be to work with the fragments that you get rather than looking for somebody to complete the tablet as it was meant to be, to work imaginatively from what you can make out of the lexical elements on your fragment to create spirited new things. Not entirely unlike what has been happening here as a result of these funny conjunctions in the patterns of these readings. So we've got some paper, we've got some pencils to hand around, and those of you who've been to some of the other poetry labs know that we kind of have been keeping something of an archive of the stuff that's been coming out of these. So some of you, I see familiar faces from Wallace Stevens Night, where we did these crazy postcard exercises, and we now have a very handsome collection of these antique postcards written over with unbelievably strange Mad Libs of Wallace Stevens poems, which may seem odd to those of you who weren't here, but it made sense if you were here. There was the notorious Whitman Night that involved figure drawings over large sheets of poetry drawn from I Sing the Body Electric, and you remember that the figure model was the notorious Mangina, performance artist with the prosthetic vagina. So we've had, you know, a set of relatively crazy events, and we want to keep the stuff that comes out of these events. So if you're writing either on the butcher paper here or on any of the other rolls of paper with the charcoal pencils that are thrown out, as you assemble fragments, we'd love it if you could actually, you know, leave them around for us. We shoot them afterwards, and the stuff, some of it ends up on the website.
So the idea is that the fragments hit you now like they hit Sappho, or like they hit some archaeologist digging them up. And the question is what to do with them. And we have the paper over there. We can maybe spread that out, get the charcoal pencils. We have fewer pencils than people, which means team up. But a number of ways of doing it. If you have just a word on a fragment and feel free to take the fragments on the table and break them into further pieces, and you want to make something of that word, scrawl it on a piece of paper, make something. If you have two words that grab you from two fragments and you want to think, how did these ever fit together, make something that stitches them. If you want to make a series of resonant words that are just fragments, do it. If you want to make a long Victorian poem, if you want to emulate Byron and stitch these into tripping iambic pentameter, do it. But do it and then cast your makings on the table here so that we can all have a look at them. And we'll do it for 20 minutes or so, and then we will convene once more and say goodnight. So have at it, please.
Robert Curry, for coming and spending the evening with us and leading us through this event. So just a round of applause for him. Read as a kind of valediction to read her translation of Fragment 31, which was just the right way to bring us off, and to do the Greek as well.
And as Anne steps to the microphone, I'll just say one more thing, which is to try this at home. I think part of what has moved me and Graham to put these things on and to do them ourselves has been a sense that there's so much more to do with poetry than sit and listen, and that making and reading are such tightly woven enterprises. So we invite you, if you come up with other fragments, send them in to poetrylab@cabinet.org, cabinetmagazine.org, right? And just even after this meeting is done, if you want to stay, keep scribbling, keep scribbling. Anne Carson. Mm-hmm.
Okay, hi. Your organizers thought it would be nice to end with the Sappho 31 again, because we had different versions of that, and I did one once. So I'm reading the Greek first, and the Greek, as Jeff said at the beginning, is a sapphic stanza, which is a metrical form Sappho invented. So it has four hendecasyllables, that's 11 syllable lines, and then one Adonian, which is a 5 syllable line. So it's a really nifty little like package of sound, each stanza. And I'll try to do it, you know, so you can hear the shape of that, but I'll probably mess it up. So, Phanetai moi kenas isas the oisin, emenoner hotis en antios toi. Is dene kai plasios had ofune, sos hupakue. Kai galaisos himeroan tomemon, kardion en stethasin neptoisen, hoskar tesi sidobrachos mephone, suden et eke. Alcam en glossa et age lepton, hauktika cro pur hupa dedromican, apatesidunan hore me pibra mesidacue. Ekademidros cacetae tramasta, paison egre chlorotera de poios, emi tethnacain daligo pidues, finoi memauta. Al pentomaton epe kai peneta, and there it breaks off. Translation. He seems to me equal to gods, that man, whoever he is, who opposite you sits and listens close to your sweet speaking. And lovely laughing, oh, it puts the heart in my chest on wings, for when I look at you even a moment, no speaking is left in me, no tongue breaks and thin fire is racing under skin, and in eyes no sight and drumming fills ears, and cold sweat holds me and shaking grips me all, greener than grass I am and dead, or almost I seem to me, but all is to be dared because even a person of poverty... ... Bracket. Thank you.